just been here.
Everybody take a seat, please.
Got some paper?
Yeah, I was going to.
On Sunday morning, it is traditional that everybody gets up really late. Just a couple of announcements. First of all, Lou, are you in here? Do you have anything at all that you want to share with the group? Or I should have asked you this before, but I got to thinking there might be some end of the weekend, whatever. Would you like to be your testimony?
I think everybody likes to grandstand, but when you're given an open invitation, how can you turn that down? To all those who think the drawing was rigged last night, it was not. No. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate all of the compliments that we've gotten, all the help that we've gotten from various people. Various people volunteered to go and pick people up at the airports and at various other locations. I mean, and I just grabbed them off the floor out here and they went and did. I really, really appreciate all that. Your support means the world to us. When this is all done, I won't have a chance to say anything more, I don't think, unless I have to. But thank you all. I really appreciate it immensely. Give yourselves a hand.
I'd like to thank whoever. I went down to the hospitality room last night about a half hour before they locked up and took money from the tip jar because I'd forgotten to do that. And whoever cleaned up in there last night, I really, really appreciate it. I asked those that were still there to at least put the garbage away. And it looks great. after we're done today, whatever items are in there, if there's anything in there that you bought personally, feel free, please, to take it home. And the rest of it's up for grabs for people who live locally. There's not as much left this year as we've had in the past. There's a bunch of pop and some snacks. Stuff. So if you want to wander in there and grab something to take home with you, that's just fine. Please do it because most of us who are in charge flew here and we're not going to be taking it home. Yeah, I don't think I'll bother with the chips. Okay, Ed Bliss gave me a note. He's got some more books available still up here. And we're going to be making it available through the Foundation website. And the Foundation will get a little commission off of doing that. But mostly we just would like to be involved in promoting Ed's book. So you can either buy it here, and if you decide to do it later, you can go to the Foundation website and purchase it there. And I just checked with Matt on the hits on the website. At this point, there's been 986 people who have clicked onto the links to listen to some portion of the weekend, which is great. This is just was such a leap for us last year when we did this because there's so many people who would like to be here and can't be here. They live too far away or don't have the money or just doesn't work into their schedule or whatever. We just received a lot of comments about having it available on the website. And what's great is it's just there all year long. And the talks from last year are still there, too. So I don't know how long we'll leave them up, but I'm sure forever, for many years, whatever. It's great. Now, before we started, I wanted to find out if there was any questions from anybody in the group, any comment of any kind of a business nature that you want to bring to our attention or situation? Just so you know, Janice has already emptied them all out and they're in the car already. I saw one other hand, Arza. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. The room next door will be open till 3 or 4 o'clock. We have the use of it, so anybody who's had to check out that we'll check out when we're finished today, and needs to have luggage somewhere, you can put it in that room if your flight doesn't go out till this evening or so forth. I've got, you know, the suite upstairs that we've been using for some of our stuff, so they, it can go in there too. So just check with me if you have a need to do that. And I didn't even check a checkout time. Is it noon here in this hotel? Yeah, they're not going to have any problem. They understand our situation. So whenever we get out of here, I'm sure we'll be fine. But there is a place you can store luggage if you need to. Yeah, and you know, I had it in my notes for Friday night and just skipped over it somehow. So, you know, there are many ex-Mormons who started their journey by reading things from the Lighthouse Ministry that Gerald and Sandra Tanner have put out. Of course, they've been so involved in helping people leave the church for so many years. And Gerald Tanner was a relatively young man, but and I wasn't aware. He had very early onset Alzheimer's, and he did pass away about a week and a half ago. Richard, is there anything about them you need to add? Okay. We do want to acknowledge. Everybody else. Well, their work has been invaluable, and I've heard so many people say, in fact, I just heard another story yesterday of somebody who was just like in the shock stage of finding out something and wandered into their old store, and Sandra Tanner took 6 hours to talk to him because he was just, you know, mentally in such a state. And I've heard that story over and over and over again about them. Linda? That's true, yeah. And for those of you who don't know what the George Pace memo was, there was, you know, a couple of books written about 15 years ago about, written by people who were involved, either as therapists, I think both of them were therapists, with some of the incidences of ritual and satanic abuse in the Valley, and the church became aware that it was probably a problem. And so George Pace, who was, I believe, a 70 at the time. Okay, you said that yesterday. Anyway, they put him on it, and he did investigate it and took back to the church that, yes, there was absolutely a problem, and it was bigger than they had thought. And then the memo was suppressed and, of course, never made public. And then the Tanners broke the story that it had been written, and I have seen at least portions of that memo, so that's what that's all about. Okay, without further ado, we decided this year to ask 4 people to come and tell us, basically in their own words, just what they wanted to share with us about their stories of leaving Mormonism. I've left it totally up to them as to whether they want to talk about the effects of that since they've left, what processes they went through, what happened to lead them out of the church. And you have their bios on your program, so I'm not going to take any time to do that. But I think what we'll do is start, Jerem, I think we'll start with you, and then we'll go.
I was hoping that by sitting on this side, I'd be last. I should have hedged my bets and sat in the middle.
Yeah. I think we'll go to you and then to Tracy and then to Dennis and then to Sandy. And we'll go to, and then when we're done, you can ask questions. I think we'll hold all the questions until each of the stories have been told. And we'll put questions at the end. Okay.
All right. Well, I was really hoping not to go first. Okay. I'm going to put this right here. Can everybody hear me okay? All right. I have a pretty loud voice, so I think this is feeding back. All right. Are we ready? Okay, my name is Jerem Smith. For those of you who don't know me, I'm 36 years old. I live in San Diego, California. I don't know where to start, so I'll just kind of start in the middle and blabber for a while, and then when someone waves their arms frantically, I'll shut up and let the next person talk. I came to my first ex-Mormon conference 2 years ago. I was very insecure and unsure about exactly how I was going to, you know, I really didn't know what to expect. I had started reading online a little bit and read about the conference, and I talked to my wife and said, hey, you know, this sounds kind of interesting, let's go. I was using an assumed name. We stayed in a different hotel. You know, I just really wasn't sure whether or not I was going to like this or what I was going to find. And what I found was a wonderful group of people, and I sort of said, hey, this is something that I think I could, you know, be more of a participant in. And I participated online, and during the course of the year, it sort of resolved a lot of my concerns, which I'll probably backfill and get to in a second. And by the next year, I had actually submitted my resignation, but I hadn't officially been, you know, kicked out and removed from the rolls or whatever. And now I am officially no longer a Mormon. So this is my third year. I feel like when I was listening to Bob yesterday talk about the different phases that people go through, it wasn't his idea. It was something that he got from a book. But that right? Was it you? It was you, right? I recognize that when I first came to the conference, I was like between a 3 and a 4. And now I think that I'm almost at a kind of a stage 5 where I'm starting to integrate things back in. A lot of the anger is gone. And I feel like a more whole person that's able to, you know, accept my life for what it is and accept Mormonism for what it is and just kind of take it and work with it. Now, in my bio, all my family and none of my friends, actually, but all my family are Mormon. My parents were temple workers recently in Palmyra, which there's a great story I want to tell, especially since I'm hoping that maybe my mom or my family will listen to this because I want to make a point to her, but point something out to her. But my parents were temple workers in Palmyra. My I have two brothers and sisters that are temple workers just locally. This is my daughter, Abby. And they're all very faithful and active, and I'm blessed to come from a very wonderful family that has not rejected me, even though I have chosen to leave Mormonism. So my family, my mom and dad spend time at my house. They kind of use my house as a waypoint when they go on trips. If they're going to travel out of town, they'll stay at our house for a few days, and I'm close with my brothers and sisters. I do business with them and things of that nature. So I'm very fortunate that it hasn't my apostasy hasn't cost me any of my family relationships. My wife is actually here running around trying to corral my child. We've been married for 3 years now, and she is a member. And a lot of people have asked me, you know, kind of like, how is that going, or you know, how does that work? And the answer is that she passionately does not give a shit about Mormonism or, you know, about whatever. She's happy to be. She enjoys Mormonism. She has a temple recommend. She enjoys going to the temple and participating with her family and doing things. But at the same time, she recognizes the truth of a lot of the things that I've experienced. And she kind of talks with me and acknowledges that. And I hope I'm not getting her in trouble, because maybe if her family listens to this. Because I don't think that some of her friends and family really know kind of where she is. She really is sort of a closet doubter. But we have an awesome relationship. And you know, there's just absolutely no friction between us because of Mormonism, so I feel very fortunate because of that. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about, well, actually, I probably won't talk about why I left Mormonism. It's the same thing that I think led a lot of us out. I came across the Book of Abraham issues, which really upset me, because I was born in 1970, and the Book of Abraham was the papyri were discovered in 1967, which was 3 years before I was born. And I was born and raised in the church. I served a mission. I, you know, went through seminary, the whole nine yards, and no one ever told me that we had the papyri. And I was just so angry when I found out that for, you know, 30-plus years, I could have known that, you know, these discrepancies existed, and no one ever bothered to tell me. And I don't know if it was because people didn't know themselves or if it was because some people knew and were just simply not saying. But in either case, I think it's tragic that, you know, for 30 plus years, I believed in something which is, I think the Book of Abraham is one of the easiest things to prove intellectually or whatever that, you know, easiest, prove is probably the wrong word to use, but it causes reasonable doubt. Would you say that's a good term to use, Dennis? Dennis says, I'd go back to prove. the Book of Abraham was the first thing. Then I read Arza's book and started really thinking about all of the inconsistencies in the Book of Mormon and the anachronisms and the language and the lack of evidences and so forth and so on. And that was part of it. And then I think the killing blow was when I read, I saw a page on the internet that had a side-by-side comparison of the Mormon temple ceremony with the Masonic ritual. And it was I had heard as a child and growing up in Mormonism that there were some similarities. But this wasn't similarities. This was exactly the same in about 25 points. The same signs, the same tokens, the same keywords in the same order. And that's not a coincidence. And so when I saw that, I said, okay, enough is enough. And by then I'd had considerable experience with ex-Mormonism and, you know, all that stuff. And so I said, I'm going to resign. And I resigned. And it was kind of interesting because I had been discussing my resignation with my wife. And she was like, you know, you do what you got to do. But when the time came, I actually just did it. I wrote it out. I faxed it to Salt Lake City. And then I told my wife. Because I was kind of, it was almost like if I don't do this, then I might never do it. And so that was how I managed to get myself out of the church. And I want to tell a story about my mom because it kind of illustrates sometimes the thinking, the weird thinking that we go through on Mormonism. They were temple missionaries in Palmyra, and we went to visit them for one of our anniversaries. And we actually got to stay in the rooms above the visitor center, which is where the general authorities stay. They're nice. They were kind of like this hotel. I mean, they were nice, but they weren't, you know, luxurious or anything. In fact, funny story, the TV didn't work, so we thought we got a kick out of that. We figured general authorities probably don't watch too much TV. We stayed there, and the whole time we were there, my mom complained and complained and complained about her mission, that, it was boring, that they'd been through the temple ceremony like 1,000 times, they had it memorized word for word, that there weren't very many people that showed up, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and I was just listening to all of this, and I was thinking, can you hear yourself? You know, are you really listening to what you're saying? Because it was just negative, 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 negative. So fast forward a few months, they finished their mission, they got home. We happened to be in their ward when they gave their homecoming speech, and she gets up, right, to give the speech, and it was just like everything was so wonderful, how much of a blessing it was to be a temple missionary. And I was going, I was just sitting there kind of shaking my head. I was unbelievably, pissed off because she was deceiving herself and by extension deceiving a lot of other people. And I just wish that I'd had some kind of recording or something that I could play and say, no, this is what you said when you were doing it. You know, this sucks, I hate it, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's easy to see those things when they happen to someone else. It's not so easy to see it when it happens to you in your own life. But that was an example to me, something close, that I could see that, you know, we have a tremendous capacity to sort of fool ourselves and delude ourselves. And I have it in myself, and we all have it in ourselves. And so it was just kind of a wake-up call. And I think for many, many years in Mormonism, that's what I did, is I sort of deluded myself. I would read things that didn't make sense, and I would forget about it. You know, I would brush it aside. And I don't do that anymore, and that's why I'm out. So I think I'll shut up now and let the other people tell their stories. Not long enough. No, sorry. Here, you can use this one.
Yeah.
Start again. Hi, I'm really glad to be here. I'm glad I was asked to speak, and
Well, my first reaction was that no way, I am not going to speak. I haven't spoken in public since we left the church 3 years ago, and I'm still pretty raw from all that. And also, too, I originally, when we first went through our trauma, I thought, there's no way I'm going to hang out with a bunch of ex-Mormons. They're all screwed up just like me. So I didn't ever expect to, like, end up speaking in front of a bunch of, you know, screwed up people just like me. But anyway, I actually don't believe that, of course, by the way. And I think you're all wonderful. And I've really been glad for the support. And I really, really enjoyed being here this year. Has been really great for me, and thank you for that. And I was thinking, you know, probably a lot of you are just dying to ask a question, and that is, how do I put up with my husband, Tal? And I kind of was thinking about that. I thought, I've already had people ask me that, like, how do you cope with that guy? That's been the first thing people have been asking me this whole time I've been here, which I kind of laugh and say, you know, oh, you know, I just put up with his, you know, his jokes and his step too far things like he usually does. And I want to say, you guys get the bizarre half of him, and I get the better half of him. So, you know, it works. Anyway, I wrote my talk down, like, pretty much word for word, because I get really nervous when I'm speaking about things that are very emotional and things that are dear to me and things that have been traumatic. So I hope you can sort of, you know, forgive me if it seems a little set up, but I really had to do this for my own self. I had a lot of points to get across, and there was only a short space of time, so I knew that if I didn't write it down, that I would deviate and get upset and things like that. So I don't want to sound like I'm at a general conference and sounding like a robot. I'm really sorry if that happens, but I don't mean to be. So anyway, I was born in Birmingham, England, to a young, inactive mother of two, and she was struggling with an abusive partner and hardly any money. I really admire her for her ability to cope, and she taught me how to be strong. She was a convert at 19 years old and stopped attending shortly after I was born. When I was an impressionable young girl of 14 years of age, missionaries were tracting in our neighborhood in Blackburn, Lancashire. My mother had been especially low and seemed delighted that they had shown up and requested that her five children be baptized. I'm sure those missionaries were thanking Heavenly Father for their good fortune in finding a family in such dire need and depression. By the way, my mother was in the church for 35 years. Has now left the church because we left, and that was a really neat thing in a way, because I was afraid to talk to her because I was afraid of losing her. She had a tendency to cut you off at any given moment if anything struck her to be, you know, inappropriate, and she had a way of doing that. She's one of those hardy, stubborn Brits, you know, and I was afraid to talk to her, and she didn't ask the questions, of course. She wasn't going to ask me. She just knew that we had fallen from grace, so she just figured she wouldn't ask me. And, you know, 2 years went by. I think it was almost 2 years, yeah, and she called me one day, and I had to listen to all of her, you know, been to the temple and how wonderful it was and glorious, but I wasn't allowed to share my part of me to her, which was really frustrating. So one day she called, and she started to talk about all kinds of things and her spiritual experiences, and I think it was the last straw for me. And I when I put the phone down, I realized that I had to overcome this fear of losing her. And not be afraid anymore. And so, just coincidentally, Tal called me shortly after he was on trip, and he called me, and I said, "Oh, I just had enough. I can't put up with this anymore. I can't." The anxiety and the upset of not ever being able to speak and speak out and be me. And he said, "Well, you know, because I knew that if I talked to my mother, I was just going to be explosive and emotional and not effective." And Tal said, "You won't want me to talk to her." And I said, "Go ahead, you're a free man," because I've always said no. You can't. I don't want you to talk to her. And I said, you're a free man. You talk to her. You know, you go ahead and do what you feel is necessary. And he called her, I think, like, right away after that. And he was on a cell phone, and he... he miraculously cracked her code and she is now out of the church. I have a mother. I have a real mother who understands me, who talks to me, and is not defensive and is not judgmental. And I have a mother. I am grateful. Anyway, after we were baptized, the five children and my mother's children, my one being myself, the church became a surrogate family for me. It meant stability and people who seemed to care. Unlike my father, who frequently would be violent, as a needy teenager, the church became my crutch. Excuse me, I need my own tissues. No. And that I became addicted to, and a way to block out harsh realities. I had observed many other converts in the church had had troubled and traumatic childhoods. I wondered so many times why that was. Was it just a coincidence? I knew the church was true by what I thought was the Spirit, and I felt like it was true. I had been taught it was a sure way to know truth. It is an extremely perverse way to control and manipulate others. I set my goals on a return missionary and definitely a man that would be unlike my father. I reached my goal with great relief. And when I said yes, kneeling at the altar in the Logan Temple when I was 19 years old on December the 1st of 1990, I knew angels were singing that day. Well, I was anyway. I was so proud of myself at reaching the temple with a wonderful man. And I remember thinking that all my troubles and strife were over. That's funny. And if we hadn't been members of church, ironically enough, maybe it wouldn't have been so stressful. And maybe largely that would have been true. Tal, my husband, was my knight in shining armor, and he saved me from a poverty-stricken area. I was hoping I could get through this. I did practice it so that I could get my tears out. It didn't work. Saved me from a poverty-stricken area where the mentality of the people was in the gutter, where getting drunk and beating up your wife was just the way things were. He saved me and I adored him for it. But of course I thanked Heavenly Father, the Prophet, Jesus Christ, the leaders of the church, and whoever else could steal the glory from those that have truly earned it. That's how I've come to see things anyway. Things started off wonderfully well. I was expecting our first son 3 months later. 3 months after we were married and 14 months after he was born, I gave birth to our second son. And 19 months later, our third son was born. And we continued on to have 5 more children after that. And now we have 8, obviously. And we surely earned our award for being fantastic Mormons. I have loved having our children. I have loved having our children. And I would do it all over again. And I mean that. If I had a second chance, I would have all of those beautiful 8 babies again. Perhaps not in a cult, but then again. I feel like... Anyway, I won't deviate. Every day I'm reminded of the beauty in this world because of them. I did question these choices, though, I'll have to say, and I'm sad to say. And I wondered if I was worthy and a capable woman for such a task after leaving Mormonism. I have to say that in reality they have given me a reason to live and to be a better person and to try to improve myself and to try to make this world a better place and most of all to love. If I could change one thing... Sorry. I said if I could change one thing, it would be free from living in a cult. As I say those words, I contradict myself by also adding that I cannot also ignore the fact that I would not be married to the man that I am and have all of my miracle children in my life. So not to fill my soul with regrets and embrace what is. I am grateful for my experiences and how filled my soul feels now. Once having emptiness and fear, the full fearless life is especially sweet. I supported my husband in all of his priestly duties, not complaining when he had to leave and serve others, with a bulging tummy as a new life grew, and I was tired to the very bone. I would put the children to bed alone at times, and I knew that he was serving the Lord. So that meant I was serving the Lord too. I felt lonely and had an ongoing struggle in my mind. I felt like something was wrong. Had a black cloud hanging over me. No matter how good things seemed, I felt like something bad was about to happen. It was always there. I had doubts and questions that I kept pushing aside, and I blamed myself constantly for being a doubter, and I knew that I would not make it to the celestial kingdom. Excuse me. And that meant I would not be with my family forever. All through these times, I really tried hard to be a good Mormon. I obeyed and did my callings to the best of my ability. And I believed that the hollow feeling I had inside was my fault. And so I would try harder to get up earlier, to pray, read my scriptures before the children woke up. I would do my callings. Excuse me. Better now. I would do my callings, and when I was exhausted, just like many others in the church, my concerns grew, and I increasingly began to worry if I would end up like the mature ladies in Relief Society. It seemed as though maturity in the gospel brought about unexplained sightings and voices, strange stories of seeing deceased loved ones in the temple used to really distress me, especially some really good ones from my mother. I wondered if I was the deficient one, and why did this not happen to me, or will it happen to me? I constantly worried about my children's salvation, and how was I going to control them so that they would not fall away from the church as they got older? It seemed as though I was on a journey at the same time as my husband, only in a completely different way. So the quiet night in August of 2003, he told me that he didn't mean to alarm me, but he thought something was wrong, and he had found some things about the church that were not in order. I listened to him. My heart was immediately pounding, and I used my mind in a completely new way. I felt something shift inside me, and I knew he was telling me the truth. Some weeks later, Tal had his epiphany, and in shock, he told me that he discovered the church indeed was fraud. Tal had always done his best in the church, and he'd been reading incessantly, always wanting to go deeper. He'd been faithful and noble always. I had no reason to doubt him. But after the initial shock, I became afraid. I told Tal I would like to do my own reading, as this was a grave matter, and he felt like that was a good idea. And then I read No Man Knows My History by Fawn Brody, Mormon Enigma, biography of Emma Hill Smith, Insider's View by Grant Palmer. Inside of the Mind of Joseph Smith was kind of one of my favorites. That really, you could really delve into his psyche, and actually, in a funny sort of way, I had been very, very angry reading all the other stuff, and I felt really angry. But in a funny sort of way, when I read Inside the Mind of Joseph Smith, I almost had compassion for a man that truly, I think, was insane. And I'm not saying anything he did was okay, obviously not. Look at the pain and suffering. But that book sort of helped me see that this he had a serious mental problem. I kind of came to that conclusion anyway. He might not have, I don't know. Other books were also helpful. I realized there was no hope of the church being what it claimed. A door had been opened and I had walked through and there was no way back. Shortly after this, Tal went for a visit with the state president and was even more shocked when the state president told him that he already knew that Joseph Smith did not always tell the truth, but that it was irrelevant to him. I then went to visit the state president myself because I thought, you know, surely something went awry in Tal's meeting, and surely the state president really did not say that. He couldn't have. Although I did believe Tal, I totally had believed him, but I had to see for myself. That's my way. I have to find out the hard way. As tears rolled down my cheeks, I asked him about all the distortions and problems, hoping he could give me some explanation as to how Joseph Smith could be a true prophet, given everything he and I both knew. He unemotionally said, "I don't really know how he could have done these things. Maybe it was just magic." As I walked out of the office with a broken heart, I realized that all of my most sacred beliefs were just lies. I kept asking myself, could this really be happening? All that I knew began to unravel and fall apart. What were the implications of such an idea? That the church was not true? What does it mean? What did it mean for our family? Was our family eternal? And what did this mean for our marriage? Questioning our marriage was one of the most painful aspects of this. I had to question it. As I felt like my prayers had been answered about Tal, I felt strongly that we were destined to be together and we were soulmates. And the way we met seemed to be divine intervention. I wondered if I had imagined all of the feelings and answers to my prayers. I now realize the church does not have ownership over all the good things in this universe or claim. Or claim on prayer and spiritual experience. I began tugging away at the tapestry that I had woven in my mind. If the church was not true, then the leaders of the church had no special inspiration, and the prophet was an ordinary man. What about Christianity? Was there a savior of the world and a God that governed it? For me at that time, it didn't seem rational that there was. Now, I admit to being agnostic. I started to doubt everyone and everything. I doubted myself and Tal, mostly myself, as I knew I had an arrested state of development. I was wrong. We had been wrong about something so crucial in our lives. I had always looked up to my husband to lead our family as he listened to the prophet, and who would guide us now? Was my husband capable? You know, I'm still kind of one. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. At the time, I didn't realize I had more reason to trust him now. In the height of confusion, it was impossible to see that Tal had always taken care of us, provided for us, and guided us, not the prophet. And that even at this moment, even at that moment, he was guiding and protecting his family by discovering the truth and letting me know. This was the most despairing and surreal time that I had had in my life. I could not see how I could separate myself mentally, emotionally, and spiritually from the cult's identity. You are the cult. A leader of the church once said, "We are of one mind facing one way." What was my mind? And which way was I facing without the church? As I had real physical shooting pains going through my heart, loss of appetite, loss of direction and identity. There seemed almost no reason for my existence. Then I would see my children, and they would pull me through another day. I had to find a way to survive. They were depending on me. I could stop crying long enough to take care of their needs only to escape and hide. And of course, Tal carried an awful lot of weight at that time, and he pretty much was a single parent for a month or so. I would escape and hide into crime, be pulled back into a world of chaos, and fall back into a depressionless, empty space in my mind. Sorry, a directionless, empty space in my mind, without any conception of self. Who am I? How could I carry the burden of being a mother of so many children who needed instruction and guidance and a strong figure as an example? I wondered with pain in my heart how could we undo the brainwashing that we and the church had done, diligently had done, on innocent, trusting minds? At the time, I thought that they would suffer immensely. I could not bear it. If only I could have known at that time how courageous they would have been through this. How smart they are, how smart they were, and how smart they are left to their own clear and ingenious minds without all of the molding, and how beautifully pure they are without our controlling. They began to be honest and open with us and told us about the things that had not made sense to them. They had intelligent, unanswered questions themselves. It made me feel weak and ridiculous for having such a hard time myself. And why, oh why, did I want to erase all that had been discovered so that I could get back into the cage of ignorance? I reminded myself of a bird like the ones from Tal's collection of canaries and finches that would occasionally escape while he was cleaning out the cage. And they would completely panic and be dive-bombing the cage in a complete fluster. And they would be trying to find the opening to the cage. That was their world as the outside of it should not exist. That was me completely. I thought my whole world had collapsed, and I mistakenly thought that I could not build another one that would be a happy, fulfilling, and safe one. I was not sure I thought I could ever feel the assured security again. I felt so hurt by the things that were said about us and people that we shared our lives with, and we loved them. And I realized I needed to shed all of the worries and not not worry about what other people thought about us, and realize that a life is not worth living if it's not your own. And my mind, I felt like my mind had been tampered with so much, and I wondered if I could retrieve it at all. I want to finish by specifically addressing how I've begun the process of recovery in hopes that something I say will help someone else. I feel like my recovery began when I acknowledged to myself how deep of a hole I was really in and that I was unable to get out of it on my own. I was just trying to be recovered without the acceptance that this would take time and effort on my part to listen to and get support from others who cared about me and not from those who did not care. I thought I could just move on and not talk about the church or hear about it. I thought it would be less painful. I had to face the issues and not run. I had to look closely at myself and decide what kind of life I wanted and what I needed to do to change and renew myself. It was somewhat helpful to see a psychiatrist and talk to somebody that had never been inside the Mormon bubble. He helped me solve a few inner mysteries. Tal has been my ultimate source of strength, and I now know a happy life can be built on a rock foundation based on reality and not the slippery, sandy foundation of lies. Reality of the here and now and what truly is important, my husband and my children, and not a crazy religion. Gratitude has been my salvation. I'm grateful to be alive and to have a free mind and an incredible, noble, and true man for a husband. Truth matters to him. I have great respect and admiration for a man that will not cave to pressures of pride and ego and risks losing the adoration of those around him for truth. I wish there were many more men like those here today in this world. I have come to learn my identity was was my own, and I was born with the rights to it and not defined by the church. I can be a loving mother without it, and my children can have joy in a fulfilling life free from the bonds of oppressive religion, of ignorance, and that they can be good people without it. They grow and bloom with love and freedom to express themselves. I have been saved. Saved from a miserable, stressful life full of empty promises, I have a renewed faith in gratitude, love, and honesty, and hope. This has brought me peace and joy. I thank Tal for saving me from an insidious religion and for saving my life. And I thank my children for my inspiration and hope for a bright and beautiful future. Thanks.
What else do you have written in that book? I could just keep reading that. That's so much better than the Book of Mormon. And I have a Pavlovian dog reaction just being here. I want to say, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. I was talking with Richard yesterday, and he said, what are you going to say? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, just speak by the Spirit. It reminded me of a post that I got in trouble for a couple of months ago on the Yahoo ex-Mormon board. I put in that I use an epithet now. I say the holy effing ghost. And I got reactions from around the world. And we were going to get T-shirts that had HFG Ghostbusters.
Never happened.
Jeremy chickened out. I've been out of the church a long time. First time I've been here, and the first time I found out about this group was probably 4 or 5 months ago after I finished writing Portals of the Night, and somebody told me, you really should go online. And so I looked, and I was amazed at what I found. When I left the church 17, 18 years ago now, there wasn't any group like this that I knew about. And I did go to the Tanners after I left the church, but I'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, the theme of our panel on the Road Less Traveled made me think of Robert Frost and, you know, how he was in the forest looking down two paths, wondering which one to take. I think he had it easier than we did, because there was no sign on the path that he was on, and he was free to choose. When we found the fork in the road, we had to face this. It said, if you take this path, you will surely die. There are people in the church right now, a whole generation, that doesn't know what that means, because the church has morphed. And when I wrote Portals of the Night, one of the reasons I did it was to reveal that information so that it wouldn't be lost to future generations. My brother has read it, and he likes my book. He's one of the few in my family that has. It must be a good book, because the Mormons all hate it, ex-Mormons love it, and non-Mormons find it intriguing. But he took it over to my niece, who was in her 30s, and she wanted to read it. She got to about the page where I'm having my murderer sitting in the temple having a spiritual experience, and she gave it back to Ron and said, I'm sorry, I can't read this anymore because Dennis lied about the temple. You know, all those blood oaths, those didn't exist. And that's what we face in 20, 40, 50 years. Nobody's going to know except we will, and we'll be passing that information. I look at Jerem. He's at the road that I started at about his age. But let me give you some background. I was born, how do I say this, because I've been thinking mythically and mystically lately. Going along with Bob's presentation, I think I might be in that fifth or sixth stage. So if I go into a Buddhist home while I'm sitting here, you'll understand. You just go ahead and carry on without me.
We'll just light some incense and let you go on your way.
That's good. So I was born on the shortest night of the year, under a full moon that was completely black. I was born June 20th on the summer solstice, and I've gone back in the computer, and sure enough, the moon was up there, but it was a new moon. And that's where I started, so I kind of like to think of myself as the Antichrist. But I was also born in the middle of Utah County, in the middle of Orem, Utah, in the middle of a farming community, in the middle of a family of eight children, where, as far as I was concerned, everybody was Mormon. Even the Catholics were Mormon. They must have had a prophet, 12 apostles. I had no knowledge of anything else, and that's how I was raised. I'm sure I was indoctrinated into the Mormon church before I could speak. In fact, I was blessed. I was probably smart enough to be able to sit there and listen to what they had to say. I wish I had been able to say what I know now. Anyway, I was raised there in the middle of the mountains surrounding Utah County in the safety of my parents' loving care. And I grew up, and being a good farmer, I was out picking apples one day, and I must have been 14 or 15 years old, and I thought, well, hell, Joseph Smith had a vision when he was about this age. How am I different than him? So I'm underneath my tree praying, and praying and praying and crying, and apparently my heart wasn't in it. I wasn't good enough, because nobody showed up. And you know what I did? Even at that early age, I said, well, I must not be worthy enough. And that's the theme of our Mormon history. But I was also addicted. I was addicted to the spirit. I loved that feeling. I can't imagine that anybody could have been a Mormon without ever having that, those feelings, the swelling in the breast and the tears running down your eyes and knowing that it was true. So that took me through all the priesthood steps. Just before I was 19, I was trying to decide whether I was going to go on a mission or not. My older brothers had both gone. It seemed like that was the path that I should follow. But I was a little bit rebellious, and I was thinking, you know, those missionaries come back and they say it was the best 2 years of my life, but I'm thinking I'm going to go to Europe and ride the trains for the summer, and I'll bet that's going to be the best 3 or 4 months of my life. And I had it all lined up with my buddy. And as fate would have it, he went on a mission. So one night I went out and I'm walking through the orchards and looking up at the stars and basically praying out loud, saying, okay, well, what do I do? And I had this great epiphany. I've had a lot of those. I love epiphanies because they feel so good. And basically it was Joseph Fielding Smith's a prophet. And once I knew that, there was no choice. I had to go on a mission. So I went to Australia, and I learned the missionary discussions that everybody's talked about, all of you know about. I learned them in 6 days and became the hero of the mission field. And I converted some people, and I hope they've all seen the light and gotten out since then. I returned home, graduated in psychology with the intent of going to law school, which is what I did. I was accepted at the University of Utah, which was quite a culture shock for me, going from basically having religious classes and praying to the first day at law school. As the first class was let out, everybody ran for the halls and there was smoke everywhere. I've never seen so many nervous people in my life. And it was in school. So that started me with my legal education, but I was still able to maintain my religious beliefs, because when you're a religious person, you can always find a way to support those categories of religion. When as soon as they step over into that area, you don't see that you're completely wrong, basically. Anyway, making a too long of a story a little bit shorter, I was called to be in the 70 when I was still in law school. I was 28. I graduated from law school a year later. I was ordained a high priest and put on the high council here in West Valley, out in Benin area, where I have one of my old parishioners here. I'm really glad she's here. I wish the rest of the ward would. After serving on the high council for a year, they called me to be a bishop when I was 29. I served as a bishop for 3.5 years, at which time they divided the stake and called me to be first councilman of the stake presidency. Dallin Oaks had been, I think, recently called to be an apostle at that point, so he came out, organized the stake, and I had a meeting with him. I was pretty sure that they should have called me to be the stake president. That should have been my first clue that the church was false. But I remember Dallin Oaks asking me during that interview, "Do you have any skeletons in your closet?" And of course, I'm going back. I hit my sister in the ass with an apple once. So somehow I got through that, and they called me to be in the stake presidency, where I served for another 3 years until I moved to Bountiful, another bastion of Mormonology. And being there, they called me immediately to be the elders' quorum, or not the elders' quorum president. I'd hate to do that. The young men's president. And I'm just assuming, well, that's the next step, or the first step before being the bishop here, and then I'll get in the stake presidency there, and I'll just keep, because that was my history. I've always been in leadership positions in the church. Well, I got to Bountiful, and I made a mistake. I went to the library. And it's not going to be what you think. I found a little book that Donald L. Taylor wrote. It's called Love, Don't Live Without It. Very short book. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So, you know, that's what we believe. We believe in love. And so he was talking about unconditional love. And he made 3 points, which at that point really made an impact on me. He said, the first thing you have to do is you have to learn to love yourself. And I'm going, hold it. Love myself. And he said, he wrote, you have to accept, understand, and appreciate yourself. When the scriptures say, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, the first thing you have to do is love yourself. It's not really a commandment, it's a truth. It's a truism. You can't love anybody better than you love yourself. Well, I took that and pretty much plugged it into my religious background, started giving talks in church about it and firesides, and people were going, what is this stuff you're talking about? What is this love stuff? And they were all getting excited about it. Well, during this period of time, my then wife started having panic attacks. We had lived in her parents' home for a few months while we built our house in Bountiful, and I had no idea about her religious background, being raised in an authoritarian home with parents who were so dictatorial and so naive that they would impose everything the church had ever said without ever making any critical evaluation of it. In fact, one of the biggest fights we had was when I had some Pepsi in their fridge. They didn't come and talk to me. They went and talked to my wife, and she basically went into a downward spiral. Anyway, we got out of their home finally, and she started having panic attacks. And whether they're biological or environmental, I have my opinion about that, probably a little of both, but I don't think the Mormon church helped much. And one night, we're getting ready for bed, and she's laying there, and she starts screaming that somebody's going to kill her. And I said, nobody's going to kill you. There's nobody here. And she said, no, God's going to kill me. And I said, God doesn't kill his children. He loves his children. And she said, no, he'll either kill me here or he will wait until after I die. And then he'll kill me. And I took her to the hospital. I took her to the emergency room. And they filled her full of Valium. And over the next 2 or 3 days, while she was sleeping in the arms of Prince Valium, I was reevaluating, I guess you would call it a significant emotional event in my life, and starting to look at everything that I'd studied and everything that I'd learned about religion, God, the commandments, and what he does to people. And I realized that she was right. And let me back up, because there, after I read that book about love, there was one day we were having a fight. It's hard not to have a fight when your spouse is a little crazy. It's hard to not to have fights even when they're not crazy. But one day I was particularly angry, and I hiked up the hill above Bountiful, and I was standing there in the day having a vicious little conversation with whoever listens to you when you're angry. And I stood on the hill, and I suddenly thought, you know, there's nothing I can do about me. I'm just who I am. You know, if I'm evil, if I'm bad, and that makes me a spawn of Satan, so be it. He can take me. If I'm good and God wants me, so be it. That's who I am. And there's nothing I can do about it. And I'm going to quit apologizing for what I am. Well, you can see right there, I was on the high road to apostasy. Because the church definitely does not believe in unconditional love. Anyway, I had my significant emotional event. My mother shows up at the house to try to take care of the family while my wife's having these problems. Should I speed up? Okay. And so I told my mom, you know, I've decided this church isn't true. I'd studied everything about Joseph Smith. I had all the information. I just filed away. I'd already read No Man Knows My History. I spent my mission studying both sides of the church doctrine so that I could answer it as bishop and state president. I had to know. And you can really make yourself believe all those things if you want to. If you start every sentence with, since the church is true, of course, when Joseph Smith lost the manuscripts and asked God if he could give them away, and God said, yeah, go ahead and let Martin Harris take them. But he had already planned that would all happen, so that he had those people, you know, 1,500 years before prepare some other plates so that Joseph Smith wouldn't be caught doing the fraud. And wow, that's such a faith-promoting story. Well, after my significant emotional event, I went, well, hell, God, should I give him the manuscripts, let him take them? No. What? No. But no. How hard is it? No. He could even explain. No. if you do that, he's going to lose them, and then they're going to have to prove it, and then I'm going to have to go back 2,000 years and get somebody else to put some plates together so that I can cover your asses. Don't give him the plates. But if the church isn't true, Joseph Smith was a fraud. Well, I told my mom, okay, Mom, this is going to be hard for you to take because I've been in the state prison. I've done all that stuff. And I said, I think it's all a fraud. I think he was a megalomaniac. And I don't believe it. I don't, you know, I've been through the temple. And, yeah, the God they worship is a mean son of a bitch. You know, who else would, you know, put you under oath with death threats? Exactly. So I'm sitting there waiting for my mom, who, you know, had joined the church after she got married to my dad. And they had gone through the temple with the first three kids. And then, of course, I was born under the covenant because I was the fourth one. And she paused and said, you know, going through the temple was the worst experience of my life. And she said, there are many things about this church that I don't believe. I think there are many other religions that teach love better than the Mormons do. And I was so relieved that she told me that. And then I was so pissed that she had never told me that. All she did was let us go to the church, let us follow that path, and I ended up exactly where I was going to end up by being brainwashed into the Mormon church. So any of you who are thinking that you're protecting your children by not taking them out of the church, I would suggest you think that through again. Let them be brainwashed for just a few more days, a few more weeks, a few more years. Anyway, I went to my mom after that, said, you guys need to get away for a while. And so she bought us some tickets to Hawaii for a week. And there I spent some time. I had taken my garments off, and on my way flying there, my wife had asked, aren't you going to wear your garments? And I said, no. And she said, why? I said, I've never... I'm never going to wear them again. But we were walking the beach in Hawaii one night, and I was explaining to her what I was going through and how I saw things. And this is a metaphor, but if you can just visualize walking along a wooden fence, and you get to a place where there's a knothole just big enough, you know, where you could see through the hole at a whole different world. And I looked through that hole and I went, I don't have to go this way. I can pretend that none of this happened. And then I said, no, I can't do that. I can't allow myself to do that. And it was as if I was ripped through that tiny hole into another world that I had never seen before. And I'm never going back. The world's too beautiful to miss by living inside of a little shell for all those years. Everything that I'd missed, all the people that I should have loved more. But so I had an emotional, a spiritual conversion out of the church. But for me, that's not enough. I had to come back. I had to study. I'm into the, well, if the church isn't true mode, if the church is false mode, now what do I do? So, of course, I go back to the library because I don't have an internet. I can't just, you know, call. As far as I know, there's nobody else that's ever left the church like I did. So I went back to the library, and I go over to the religious section, and I find this book, and it's about the book of Abraham. And I open it up, and I start reading, and in about the first two or three pages, I go, shit, I did what? It's like, hold it. I served mission. I studied all this stuff. I've been a bishop. I've been a stake brother. I know all about the church. Why hasn't anybody told me about this? So I contact a patriarch or another stake president friend of mine, and I say, do you know anything about this? He says, I don't know anything about that, but I can try to get some information. I know some people over at the church archives, and let's get some information. I'm sure there's an answer to this question. And they sent these Sunstone articles, and I always thought that's like, those were the evil people. Now the church is sending out this stuff saying, well, yeah, you know, Joseph Smith did say, you know, he wrote on there, on the book of Abraham, that it's written but in the hands of Abraham. Translation. But now that's not what happened. He was just like looking at the facsimiles, and I started thinking, hold it. This makes no sense. And then I said, well, you know, this is a pretty important decision. Maybe I should check it out with the general authorities. So the only guy I knew was Dallin Oaks, really, personally. So I sent a letter saying, you know, when you interviewed me to become a state president, you asked me if there were any skeletons in my closet. Does the church have any skeletons in its closet? And I really didn't expect a response. I mean, by then, I'd had 8 kids. I said, I'm taking my 8 kids. We're going. You know, unless you can answer this question. And I get a call from his office, and they schedule an appointment. So I go, well, great. Maybe he's got an answer. So I show up at the appointed time and place, and we're sitting in his office, and I go through, and I said, you know, the facsimiles, from what I've been told, have been sent to, you know, 8 different Egyptologists, and they all come back with the same story, and the story has to do with Hor and Isis and Osiris and Anubis, and I wish Joseph Smith had been able to translate, because he would have got a lot closer to the truth. But, so what's the deal here? I said, you're a lawyer, I'm a lawyer. If we brought 8 experts and they all translated this the same, would you believe Joseph Smith? And he said, yes. He says, that's my faith. And I said, it's always been my understanding that the purpose for faith was to take us from the information that we know, jump the gap to what we don't know. It's never been intended to eliminate the facts that we know. Okay, I think I can finish. Now you interrupted my thought. What was I saying? Oh, I was talking to Dallin Oaks. And he leaned back in his chair, kind of like this. Well, you know, I've got the witness. And I went, this guy doesn't know anything. And then he said this. Don't leave until you find something better. And I mentioned this the other day. It was one of the few times in my life when my comeback came back at exactly the right moment. And I leaned forward and I looked him in the eye and I said, nothing is better. And nothing is still better.
No, I can't. I just can't describe the good feeling of being here this weekend. I'm kind of an old timer here. I came to the first conference in 97, and it's just amazing to see how it's grown, and it's amazing to just be in a room full of like-minded people that, you know, thought their way out of the church, and that's just a great, great feeling. And so in the past, everyone I think on the list and boards have known me as Sandy Gilkison, but I just officially changed my name and took back my maiden name, so I'm now going to be known as Sandy Crane from this point forward. So, yeah, that was a good feeling. That was a big step. And so I live in Seattle, Washington, but I grew up in the church in Oklahoma, and I grew up in the mission field, and I can honestly say I didn't have a bad experience in the church growing up. As a child, it was kind of an idyllic situation. I had the girls' camps and primary and YW, and in my youth, it was just really fun back then. I sense that the church has changed a lot since then, and it's not the way it was. So I did grow up in the church. I guess my mom's side of the family, they were among some of the first Mormons in the state of Arkansas, and that was back in the 1890s. They had to keep their affiliation, I guess, with the church a secret, because that's where a lot of the victims of the Mount Meadows massacre were from. And so so finally, I guess, they escaped Arkansas, and then I grew up in Oklahoma after that. As a child, I was happy and active in the church, as I mentioned. I guess my dad, he wasn't active. He drank coffee. He had this horrible habit, and, it kept him out of activity, and it was kind of a big stigma. Your dad drinks coffee. And I just feel bad for him that they just kind of laid that on him for years. It kept him out of the temple, kept him out of true activity, and I just think how... That was just so ludicrous. And so growing up in the church, I felt special. I felt like I was among the elite from the pre-existence, and I was chosen. But I had some things that bothered me about myself as a child. I had a stutter. I still stutter, but it's kind of been something I've had my whole life. Then as a 12-year-old, I got my patriarchal blessing, and I can kind of pinpoint the day that I got this blessing, and it really kind of set me on kind of a new way of thinking. And I think back on this blessing, and it was a heavy burden to put on a 12-year-old child, because basically in this blessing it said that it said that through my faithfulness I would stop stuttering, and it said if I didn't live faithful that basically my time as testing on the earth would come to an end. So that's a big threat for a child, be good or die. And it was like, it started me on this line of just kind of extreme thinking. I feel like I had stay good and be faithful and live morally clean, or I just had this big risk of damnation. And so it really motivated me, I'd say through, my teen years. I've got a few notes here too, and it just made me, especially through high school, there were only a few Mormon girls in my high school, and it motivated me to, kind of separate myself from the non-Mormon crowd. It motivated me to, basically, I guess, live a clean and healthy life. But it was, it was all based on fear at the time. I know that now, that it was just based on that, on that promise and my patriarchal blessing, you know, stay faithful, Lord, you know, you're going to be taken out. And so I very much bought into the whole idea that, you know, my goal is motherhood and marriage. And by the time I was 17, I had met my future husband. I mean, I was engaged by the time I graduated from high school and planning our temple wedding. And that was just my goal. It was like the idea of college at that time. I, you know, maybe I'll do that someday, but my most important thing is being a wife and mother. It was the summer of 82, and my soon to be husband and I started planning our temple wedding and got our recommends, and it was just, you know, special time. About 3 months before our wedding, he got called into a court from a previous bishop, and he got X'd. And it was a shock because, I guess one bishop had given him this recommend, and then another bishop said, no, I think for some things that, you know, you did a few years ago, I think we should X you. And so, I mean, I was devastated. It was like, I wanted, you know, that temple marriage. That was a big deal to me. But I loved him, and I stuck by him, and we had a civil wedding. And talk about a shameful experience in the church. It's just like you are just looked on like, you know, oh, gosh, I bet she's got to get married. Or, you know, it was quiet, hush, hush. They didn't want to have, you know, a reception in the church. They tried to make me get married in the, you know, inside the Relief Society room. And it was just, you know, very sad time. It was like I expected my wedding, you know, would just be a special day. It should have been a joyous day. But I was told by everyone, you know, just wait for the temple. It's going to be so beautiful, and that'll be the wedding that you never had, and it's going to be the best day of your life. And so I kind of held out for that, and I just thought, okay, and I've got that off here in the near future, and I'm going to plan and prepare and be ready for that. So we got married in 1983 and started having kids. I mean, that was my duty at the time. And by the time that we finally made it to the temple in 1990, I already had four kids. And planned for the day, you know, I had my family there. I'd been to the temple prep classes a few times, paid so much tithing. I just think back to, you know, okay, well, we have to make sure we paid for last year, this year, the year before, just to kind of make sure I was totally ready. I took it very seriously. I saw this day as, you know, it's going to be like the windows of heaven are open. I'm going to, you know, maybe see spirits, or maybe, you know, see things that, you know, people have claimed they've seen in these inspirational stories. And so I was really excited. And, you know, we prepared our kids and had my family there. And, you know, words can't describe, you know, my sense of disappointment for that day. I was just, I think someone set my expectations way too high. It's just like, it's going to be wonderful, beautiful, and oh, you're going to be so happy. And I came out of there feeling violated. Like, you know, and sad and so like, I was like angry at myself because I didn't get it. It's like, hey, what did we just do? Okay, we learned these handshakes and a name, and we had to go say all of these bizarre things, and I don't get it, and so it must be me. I mean, it must be me, and I really took it, you know, very personally. Like I should have gotten this. I know, I mean, I thought I was worthy, and but I just got nothing that day. You know, kind of an interesting event happened About 3 weeks later, I guess my husband and I saw the musical Les Miserables for the first time, and I mean, I came out of that and felt very moved, felt very spiritual, and I thought, yeah, you know, that's the experience I, you know, kind of expected in the temple, that I would just be in awe and you know, be touched. And it was amazing, you know, feeling that outside of the temple, outside of the church, and feeling it in this beautiful musical, in this beautiful story. So that kind of, you know, that kind of led me into a way of thinking that you know, I had to, you know, start being better. I had to be better. I had to go back to the temple and get it. I wanted to feel that spiritual experience and that burning of the bosom and know that this was true and this was right. So over the next couple of years, it led me into having a couple more kids. I was, you know, I was 28 with six kids. And by the time my youngest was, he was born, my oldest was only eight. And it was a very strange time. It's like I sometimes look back on it and it's like I really don't have a lot of memories of it. It's like I think I was just in this blur and this fog of just, you know, I'm just doing so much. And yet in the back of my mind, it's like, well, maybe I'm not doing enough. You know, maybe I should have more kids. Maybe I should just do more. And it was just like I was just, you know, kind of racking my brain as to what more can I do. You know, paid tithing and taught in classes for years. We stayed very active. I was in multiple presidencies and so was my husband. But the next, you know, few years after that, it was a hard time for our family. I guess we lost the business. You know, our marriage started struggling. There was some abuse in the marriage that, you know, a couple of bishops, you know, kind of put on me and said, you know, just be a better wife. You know, be a better wife, you know, make sure that you're satisfying your husband. Make sure that you're cooking good meals, and then the abuse will get better. And it was just, and so, you know, kind of again, it was just being put on me. So, you know, it was my fault I didn't get the temple. It was my fault I was being abused, and it just kind of led me into this really dark place for quite a few years, And then, of course, being unhappy in the church is a whole other stigma into itself. I mean, there's this mentality that if you have the gospel, that you should be happy. I mean, that is the, you know, it's the gospel of Christ. And, you know, I'm among some of the most special spirits on earth. I should just be so thrilled with my life. And yet, I was miserable. Absolutely, I was absolutely miserable. And I thought I was the only one. I thought, you know, I bet I'm the only person in the church on Prozac. I bet I'm the only. No, I really thought that, though. I took my medicine in secret. I didn't even let my husband know at first because it was just, I felt so badly about it. In fact, for a year before I actually started medication, I was urged by my doctor, you know, you have major depression, you know, take some meds. No, I'm fine. I would say it was the summer of 95. I was in my ward in Kent, Washington, and this was a, you know, probably a defining moment in my life this day. And I had quite a few of them in, you know, that period of time, but this was one of the big ones. I mean, I already kind of had stuffed the temple question in my mind and the abuse question in my mind and just a lot of, you know, things I've seen over like the years. But I just kind of didn't go there. And I was, but in the summer of 95, I was in this sacrament meeting and this woman in the ward stood up and she was one of the kind of one of the women in the ward that, you know, is really beautiful. She's really intelligent. Everybody thinks that she has it all. Had the singing voice of an angel. And you're going to say, oh, you know, she's got everything. Well, you know, she and her husband were speaking in sacrament, I guess this one Sunday. And she got up and she just talked and talked and talked, you know, about how depressed she was. About how she had this black cat cloud over her head all the time, about, you know, about how some days she couldn't get out of bed. And I was stunned. I was like, you know, she feels that way. And then after church that day, you know, there was a line of women who were like, oh, I thought I was the only one, and I'm on this, and I'm on this. Oh, yeah, I'm on Prozac. I'm on Viagra. They were just like, it was all of a sudden this exchange of what everybody's on. And it, all of a sudden, it's like the cat is out of the bag. I mean, I'm sure that day goes down in history, you know, for that ward. That was a bad day for our ward. You know, half of the women in our ward are really unhappy. And damn, they told everyone. But for me, just kind of a bell went off in my head. It's like, why are we all so miserable? Why are we all so unhappy? And it started to become the discussion in Relief Society meeting talks. But, you know, we started just kind of hanging out, talking about stuff. And that was a big event. And still for the next year, you know, kind of just plowing through life. I have my 6 kids and trying to support my husband, who had just moved up to Seattle so he could work in the high-tech industry. And you know, I was alone a lot of the time, and I was still, you know, suffering from a lot of things, a lot of sadness. About a year later, my daughter, who at the time was 10, stood up in a fast and testimony meeting, and you know, she was, you know, very outspoken girl, very outgoing, great speaker even for a 10-year-old, and you know, it was like, oh great, there's Morgan, she's so great, and you know, she's standing up there speaking, and you know, she gets up there and says, I know this church is true, I know the Book of Mormon is true, I know Joseph Smith was a true prophet. And a couple of things hit me just immediately. It's like, I've taught her how to lie. And I've been saying these for, you know, all the same stuff for all these years. And I've taught her how to say this. I've trained her very well. And she doesn't know any of this. You know, and it just really, it's like that. I had heard her speak before, but on that particular Sunday, it really just struck me as very strange. And, you know, my gosh, I was, you know, still waiting for the burning in the bosom. I was still waiting so I could get the temple and get, you know, she's up here saying, I know this is true. So it kind of lit a fire under my butt, and I decided, you know, I've got to go increase my testimony. I've got to go and read the Book of Mormon again. I'm going to just have to pick up my scripture study and just study more. I'm going to have to, you know, study about Mormon history so I can know these things. I want that burning in the bosom. I want to have that witness. And so that Sunday after church, you know, I had a new mission. And the goal of my mission initially, you know, I was going to increase my testimony. That was my goal. That was my only goal, was to, you know, just try to become a better Mormon. And a lot of things changed that day. I started to reread the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants, and I got out my old, you know, sturdy Mormon doctrine, and I used to love to read those, you know, just bizarre things. Just some of those teachings from the Mormon doctrine were just like, it's like sometimes I loved, oh, that's so freaky, that's so cool. And but then I thought, you know, this isn't enough. I've read this before. So I decided to get on the internet and look for some really inspirational stories on the church, and thinking it was going to lead me just to these great, wonderful things. And, of course, they did lead me to some great, wonderful things. But it was very different from, you know, what my expectation was. So, and this, you know, again, was like the summer of 96. And so I typed the word Mormon into the search engine. And, you know, what came up? You know, one of the first things I found was the Recovery for Mormon site. And I was terrified when I found it. Really, really scared. I started kind of going through the first, you know, like the first few stories. And it's like, I shouldn't be reading this. You know, this is really scary. This is anti-Mormon stuff. And yet I was reading some of the stories and they didn't. Like, it really wasn't. It was just, I thought the people seemed very real. I thought they seemed very normal instead of you know, people who, you know, just had this horrible axe they want to grind. It was more just about, you know, how they had been kind of normal in the church, and they had found their way out. These stories just blew me away, and I was kind of doing this in secret behind my husband's back, and I kept reading for about 3 months, and and then I read, you know, I started on several books. I loved the Emma Smith, The Mormon Enigma. That was a big eye-opening book for me. I read a couple of books by B.H. Roberts. And then I got to No Man Knows My History. And I got to about chapter 12 of that book, and I think this specific chapter, it was on the Kirkland Temperance Society and kind of about the origin of the Word of Wisdom. And the Word of Wisdom, I mean, it was something I always thought was very interesting because, you know, some of it made so much sense. You know, the health code, and I thought it was inspired. It had to be inspired. It was just so... It was so smart. And I'm pretty smart. I mean, but I got to the end of that chapter and I put the book down and I just cried because I just realized I was about to lose my belief system. And all those questions I had stuck in my head for all these years started kind of pouring out, the, you know, the abuse and all the corruption I'd seen, you know, among leaders in the church, and you know, the whole temple experience, and it just all started. It was like on that day, that was my day, and it really, you know, the whole thing cracked open, and I knew I couldn't go back, and so I assumed I would have a big challenge in front of me. My ex-husband, yeah, was a convert, and but I just assumed he'd want to stay in the church, and I thought, how am I going to tell him? How am I going to approach him? You know, what are we going to do? And I approached him. It was the fall of 96, and you know, took him for a walk, and I just said, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading, and I'm really questioning my testimony. In fact, you know, so much that I don't believe I can stay in the church in good conscience. I feel like it's a lie. And so I showed him some of the things I read, and then he just, you know, being a convert and probably being someone else who never quite, you know, felt like he fit in, and he just hugged me and said, I'm so happy. I never thought this would happen. I never thought this would happen. And so all of us ended up having our names removed in, it was March of 97. Coincidentally, our marriage fell apart about a month later because, you know, I just kind of realized it had been the church that had been, you know, keeping our marriage in this kind of dysfunctional state, and now, you know, I didn't have to. So a lot of hard things happen in a few months. I mean, you know, leaving the church and getting a divorce, it's really hard for six kids. I felt like it was for my survival. I had to, but, you know, I'll admit, for my kids, it was really difficult. And trying to raise six kids out of the church, I mean, there's not a lot of support for, you know, people that have six kids. And so that was a big challenge. I had some big discoveries in the summer after I left. So I, you know, kind of like Bob said in his talk yesterday, I was just on this high. I was on this high for just months. I mean, everything was beautiful. I was, you know, I was part of this lone and dreary world all of a sudden, and I felt like I was in heaven. And I would cry at sunsets. I'd see Mount Rainier at sunset glowing, and, you know, I'd have, you know, maybe, you know, some Peter Frampton playing in the background, and I just burst out in tears. It was just incredible. And then that summer I had a bigger discovery, and there's someone from this, you know, from the ex-Mormon group, named Nolan Meekham, who came to the first few conferences, and he was having a retreat at his house in the summer of 97, so I had the opportunity of driving from Seattle down to the Northern California coast, and I had the chance of driving through the Redwoods for the first time, and I got to the Redwoods, and I became so overwhelmed, I had to stop the car, and I had to walk through the trees, and I stood there in that forest, and I wept. It was just so spiritual and so beautiful, and I just thought, you know, this is my temple. I don't need a church. I don't need a temple to have spiritual experiences, and it's like I had this new spiritual awakening, and that, you know, it was the beauty and the appreciation of the outside world that just blew me away. It was just something I didn't appreciate before, and all of a sudden, you know, here's this beauty that surrounds us in this, you know, this beautiful world, and I was just so moved by it. You know, it's been about ten years since we've been out. And it hasn't always been easy. I mean, you know, my oldest son struggled a lot. He's now 21, and we left when he was 12, so he missed out on, you know, being a deacon and all those other things. But I've raised a bunch of free-thinking kids, and, you know, sometimes that's hard because they like to question everything I say, too. But, you know, now my four oldest are in college. I have a new life. I feel like after I left the church, I could be anything, anyone I wanted to be, and I could just reinvent myself. And, you know, now I work in the high tech industry. I camp. I travel. I cycle. I also run the post-Mormon support group in Seattle. So I still try to stay actively involved. As you can see, I still stutter, but I'm still alive, which is a very happy thing for me. And that daughter that stood up a decade ago and stood up in church is now a 20-year-old jazz musician who I'm so proud of. Babies and marriage is, you know, it's not even on her radar. And so I feel like our life started after we left the church, and I'm very proud of where my family is and where I am, and I'm so happy I can be part of this group.
Let's take about 15 minutes max to, if anyone has questions, we'll take them, but we want to preserve time for our mic time, so why don't we do this? We'll take one question per person for those, if anyone has that. If not, we'll just go into our mic time. Question here?
Yeah,
Mike?
It's pretty fresh and new. I mean, how long has it been? Well, a year. And she's dealt with a lot of other factors. And actually, she's still... she still believes in Christianity. That's for her. That it's a way for her. And so I haven't wanted to, you know, bring things up that might be hard for her and that might cause her to feel upset or embarrassed. So I just have left that alone.
Any others? Okay, we have about an hour. Oh, was there one back here? Oh, sorry.
Is it on? My question is for Tracy. Also, I'm a stay-at-home mom with three kids. This is kind of a boundary question. The programs in the church, I'm now learning, missionary, visiting, teaching, home teaching, are boundary breakers, an invasion of privacy, and because we're all brothers and sisters, people feel entitled to know your business. And so as we are exiting out, I'm still dealing with that. People knocking on our doors, they need to know our business. So do you have any suggestions for rebuilding boundaries?
Well, basically, I just ignored everyone. Well, and I said to Tal, I said, just tell everyone, because I was in so much inner pain. I was not prepared to deal with the things that they needed from me. And you just have to draw the line. I mean, and Tal just said, we don't want anybody here. We don't want anybody calling. We need our space right now, and you need to leave us alone. And for the most part, they respected that.
I'm a firm believer in what the church calls the no-contact letter. That's how I transitioned out. The day I walked out of church for the last time, I had taught a Relief Society lesson that day, and I walked out. I have explained it many times, like I had a hand on my back pushing me down that hallway, and I knew it wasn't coming back. And I took all my books, put them in a plastic bag, and put them on the doorstep of the church the next day. And the second day, I took a no-contact letter to my bishop. And I'm pretty strong-minded, as you might guess. And I'm a good writer, so I made it very plain. I meant no contact. And I took it over, and unfortunately, he answered the door. So I had to hand it to him directly, but they never contacted me again. So if you're not ready to make the big step, I think the no contact letter is a very good way to go.
I'd like to add something to that, if I can. when it comes to boundaries, I think there's a lot that we can learn about boundaries from the areas of psychology. In my particular case, my first marriage was a horrible marriage, and this is something I didn't really even talk about because I really don't want to spend a lot of time talking about my ex-wife. But the church has horrible boundaries. I was raised in the church. I was given horrible boundary skills. That set me up for a marriage which had horrible boundary problems. And one of the ways that I got out of that first marriage was learning boundary skills. And that was done by studying psychology and studying boundaries. So one way that you might be able to help yourself out is learn more about boundaries, healthy boundaries, by talking to a psychologist and explaining kind of some of the problems that you're having with an invasive organization or an invasive person or something, and say, how can I set healthy boundaries? There's a lot of knowledge out there in the field of psychology that can help you learn how to set healthy boundaries, and then that information will be applicable to the church and really to all other aspects of your life. So I just wanted to add that.
Good.
I was going to add something to that. I mean, not the after, you know, you're there, but going into it, I actually wrote up a confidentiality agreement and handed it to my bishop and said, I won't talk to you until you sign this. I don't want to be talked about in your PECs. I don't want to be talked about, period. If you talk about me, or if it starts, it comes up, stop.
Did he sign it?
He signed it.
Interesting.
He wasn't quite sure what to do with it because he'd never been approached with it before. But, yeah, I mean, it, you know, going into it, it was like, stop.
the whole boundary issue, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the central things that we have to learn as we leave the church. I mean, the church believes they own your life. They own your thoughts. They have the right to invade your home, your mind, your heart, your psychology, anytime they want. And it is, I've heard this over and over again, it is, and that's why so many exiting Mormons go into that spin-out period when they leave, because they get out into the world, they don't know how to say no to anybody. They don't know how to say, you're in my space, leave me alone. You know, they're just very, very vulnerable, and it's a dangerous time in a lot of ways, even though it's exhilarating. So I think the learning of to set boundaries, you know, most Mormons don't even know what you're talking about when you say that. I have a boundary here. Don't evade it. Ken? Exactly. That's good. That's a very good idea, because they can give you resources.
Hey, Sue?
Yeah.
Can I say something?
Sure. Oh, no. Because they invade your boundaries right away. Okay, Cal?
Just check, 1, 2.
Okay.
That's next song. No. I just one comment about the boundaries. It's true that, when we first sort of had that realization and we crashed or whatever, you know, a couple of times, you know, people called inquiring about Tracy, and I said, you know, Tracy just... space, etc. But I just wanted to pass on something that's been really, really effective for me in terms of boundary setting, and in fact doesn't really involve setting any boundaries at all. So this is it. I'm just throwing it out there in case it helps anybody. Like when you're in that state and you have that psychological and emotional dependence, and it's sort of, you have fear. I mean, you're a believing Mormon, and you just want the whole world to be Mormon, just like you. I mean, there's this whole thing, like, you will do anything to stay in that state. Anything.
So
you will kick your kids out of the house. You will, you will do anything to keep your testimony, quote unquote. So what I did, like, one thing that's very effective is, if you talk to somebody after you figure out the church is a fraud and they leave, word spreads really quick. People start to think you have magical satanic powers. They're absolutely afraid of you. And I don't think I could get members of the church to come over to my house if I begged them. And here's the thing that I've done a couple times. Like, my home teacher came over, like, shortly after we figured it out or whatever, and chit-chat. And, you know, everything from sort of just love-bombing to sort of directly approaching the church. So what I've done is, when the church comes up and that conversation is initiated, I say, you know, I would love to talk to you about this, but I want to ask you a question first. If by some crazy chance Joseph did not tell the truth about his experiences and the church was not what it claimed, would you want to know? And that scares the hell out of them. It scares the hell, and for most of these guys, it's the first time they've ever even been able to think hypothetically about something like that. If they say no, then you say, well, then we don't have anything to talk about, do we? You wouldn't want to hear what I had to say, would you? If they say yes, you're in like Flint, and an hour later, they're out with you.
There's one up here.
I just have a question for, is it Jaron?
Jaron.
With you and your wife, where she decides to go and stay involved for whatever degree she does, I'm just kind of wondering what decisions you guys have talked about regarding raising your children.
That's a very good question. The answer is, we're still kind of figuring it out. I have two children from a previous marriage. I have a 9-year-old girl, and she was baptized in the church. She was baptized in the church before I really had kind of made my decision. I was feeling like I didn't believe it, but because of the situation with my ex-wife, I didn't want to acknowledge my non-belief because of her, in front of her, because I didn't want her to bring it up in court. I had a Mormon judge, I had a Mormon attorney, et cetera, et cetera. Even though I live in Southern California, I just had the bad luck of having a lot of Mormons. Since then, you know, I've kind of come clean about that, and it's less of an issue. But I've talked to my daughter, Valerie. She knows that I don't believe the church is true. I have told her in the simplest possible terms that I can, why not? And as she grows up, I plan to, you know, basically give her more information. Currently, she really enjoys attending church, and I kind of let it happen. But I've heard a lot of stories, like from Sue, you know, whose kids now don't want to have hardly anything to do with her because, you know, she's the evil apostate, and I certainly don't want that to happen with my daughter. Abby, the little girl that's running around, was blessed in the church. I allowed it to happen because what's the harm? Like I said, my whole family is LDS, and so my dad did the blessing and stuff, and it was at my house. It wasn't at church, and so there were some compromises there. But it is a difficult question because I want to raise... I appreciate a lot of the values that I have from Mormonism. I appreciate sort of the Judeo-Christian ethic, although right now I'm not sure. I call myself an apatheist because I really don't know or care if there is a God. I'm open to the possibility, but unless he kind of smacks me over the head, I'm not going to worry too much about it. But I believe in being, you know, kind and nice and honest and all of those things, and I think that...
In other words, an ethical person?
Well, yeah. No, I'm highly ethical, and I have a lot of integrity, which is actually why I left the church, because I said... I actually had a talk with my bishop, and in the letter that I wrote, I said, I'm leaving because I can no longer, in good conscience, be a member of this organization. And so getting back to your question, it's a good question. It's one I haven't fully resolved, and it's one that we really haven't fully discussed. So it's kind of a, right now we have a compromise where we go to church sometimes and we don't go to church other times. My wife is actually concerned. We were discussing last night. She's concerned she won't be able to get her temple recommend renewed. And there's a pretty good chance that she won't because she doesn't go to church. I don't pay tithing. There's... She doesn't really believe that Joseph Smith is a prophet. She doesn't believe that the Book of Mormon is true. If this is still being recorded, I'm probably getting her in a lot of trouble. So
we can edit it.
She associates... That was actually what we were discussing last night. She associates with apostates. The mere act of being here makes her ineligible for a temple recommend, possibly. But you've got the competing fact that she's supporting her husband, and that's supposedly a good thing, too. So, it's a good question. It's a difficult question. It's one I don't have an answer to. It's actually one of the things I was going to talk to Tracy and Tal and other people that have kids to kind of say, hey, how are you dealing with this? Because I don't know. The way I'm dealing with it, I think, is a kind of a half-assed bad answer. We're kind of doing half and half, and I don't think ultimately that's the way it's going to be in the end, but I haven't come up with something better.
Okay, I think we'll cease the questions now. We will give about the next 55 minutes to mic time again for those who would like to come up and just share their feelings about the weekend. And we would like to limit these to just a couple of minutes apiece. I think we'll do the timekeeping again, but we will try to make them really short. Everyone is tired on Sunday morning, I realize, but there always seems to be a few people who would like to express some things about the weekend. So if you would like to do that, except that it looks like half of you are starting to leave. So.
Just so you
pardon?
Know, we're turning off the recording equipment now.
Oh, yeah, we're turning off the recording equipment now,
thanks
too.
Thanks for coming, and if you hear this on the Internet, thanks for listening.